Dalad Minim, at the conclusion of a Shmita year, I shared the story already, but I'm going to go for it one more time. My son Aaron and I were walking to shul Sunday evening at about 6:15 up 73rd Avenue, and we were watching the sunset over Kew Gardens Hills in the west. And I said to Aaron, what is the difference between this sunset and every other sunset you've ever witnessed? So I borrowed this from Rabbi Soloveitchik in a different context. But I said, Aaron, when the sun sets tonight, this sunset indicates the cancellation of all loans, the end of Shemitah, everyone's going back to work in the farms. The Rav Soloveitchik tells a story when he was young, his father took him outside. I guess there was maybe a little break before Ne'ilah, before Mincha, the afternoon of Yom Kippur. And he said, look at the sun. He said, what's unique about this sunset? Different than the rest of the year. So he said, this sunset brings kapara at the conclusion of Yom Kippur. So there's something beautiful about appreciating how Hashem's world of halacha integrates with the natural world as well. We're supposed to look for those connections. It says, Histaka b'oraisa u'bara alma. Hashem looked into the Torah and used that as a blueprint for creation. So this is one of the many examples of how we can truly appreciate that in real time. So Shvius Shemitah has concluded. But the truth is, even after the sunset, there's a number of halachos that persist and have relevance over the next couple of months, maybe even a little bit longer. The longest one, perhaps, is wine that was produced during Shemitah, right? It doesn't hit the market for a while. If it's a really fancy wine, it could be years before it hits the market. But certainly it'll be a few months before you start to see bottles that say Shemitah Tufshin Pei Base or something like that. So that's one example. There's plenty of fruits that will still be on the market. There's different types of produce are evaluated, are assessed with their Shemitah status differently. Meaning to say that when it comes to vegetables, if it's harvested during Shemitah, it's subject to Shemitah. If it's not harvested until afterwards, then, you know, if someone picks a cucumber today, it has no rules of Shemitah governing. We call that basar lakita. When it comes to other things, such as fruits or grains, so there are two different standards. One is called basar chanata, goes based on when the fruits blossomed, or hava shlish, when it grew one-third of its full maturity. So if something, let's say, was on the tree prior to Rosh Hashanah and was only picked now, like an esrog, okay? Any esrog that was picked last week also is subject to Shemitah, but even an esrog that was picked after Shemitah's over could be subject to the laws of Shemitah, and for that matter, other fruits of the tree, the Jaffa oranges are going to be, you're going to find them in Costco or wherever, they're still going to be subject to Shemitah for a little bit. Okay. Other examples that we don't need to encounter as readily that persist after Shemitah is, number one, Yovel. If this was a Yovel year, there would be another year of refraining from working on the fields. But our Parsha actually talks about the mitzvah of Hakel. The Torah says that at the end of the 7th year period, at the end of Sukkot, in the 8th year, the mitzvah of Hakel is performed. Maybe we'll talk about it more as we get closer to Yontif. But Dalad Minim, you're going to see a bunch of unusual phenomena in the market. You go to Main Street and you buy your Lulav and Esrog, or you order it from the shul. I don't know where the source for where the shul's Dalad Minim are, so I shouldn't try to address that. But on the street, you'll see a few unusual things. You'll see, for example, much higher volume of Esrogim coming from Morocco, from Italy, and now California, as opposed to a normal year where just about everything you see is from somewhere in Israel. Another unusual thing you'll see this year is those Esrogim that come through Otzer Basin. I'm going to try to give a little explanation of that in a few minutes. If they're designated as Shemitah produce, what they should, the way they should appear is taped up and sealed, so you can't even look inside. You have to buy it as is, whatever's inside. So in many many merchants will not have these boxes of $70, $80, $90, $35, but there'll be one size fits all, and you know, you get whatever you get, and as they say in kindergarten, you don't get upset. Okay, but let's talk a little bit about the background behind that. That's what our kids say at home. Okay, so we have four species to try to address in the next 14 minutes. So the Arav is the easiest. The reason why the Arav is the easiest is because it really has no issue with Shemitah. Happens to be, I think, our Aravos in America generally come from Muncie or from Arizona. So, I don't know. That's where they're growing them. But even if you got Aravos in Israel, the reason why those don't fall into, we'll say, the category of Shemitah sensitive is because our rabbis are just twigs. They're just wood. Why is that important? Because as the Torah tells us in Parshas Bahar, where most of the halachas of Shemitah are introduced, V'haysa shavat ha'aretz lochem le'achla l'cha l'abdechol v'amasecha. This year, everything that grows during this sabbatical year for the fields is lochem le'achla. It's for you, and it's for you to eat. So we derive from that a number of halachas. One halacha is lochem le'achla v'lo l'schora. You can't do business with produce of Shemitah. Okay, right? You have to open up your field, let anyone come and pick and do whatever they want with it. Lochem also means that there's a specific type of benefit you're supposed to get from it. And if an item or some sort of produce is not generally used for that specific form of benefit, then it's not subject to Shemitah altogether. So fruit, we'll get back to fruit in a second, the esrog. Esrog is fruit, right? So lochem l'achla is definitely referring to the fruits of the tree or the vegetables that grow from the ground. But something which is just wood, something which is just a twig, has no rules of Shemitah that apply to it. Okay, so Arovas can pretty much get anywhere. Hadassim are a little more complicated because hadassim do provide smell, right? Everyone knows each one of the dalaminim, this one has a smell, doesn't have a taste, and so on and so forth, different permutations. So hadassim have a smell. So the Yishalmi has a question whether or not besamim, which grow on the ground, does that have the status of something which would be subject to Shemitah? Is it a type of benefit that would be relevant to Shemitah? Now, why would it or would it not? So when it comes to fruit, okay? So the category that the Gemara defines when it comes to fruit is hana'asan ubi'uran shava. You benefit from it, and it also is consumed simultaneously. So when it comes to fruit, you eat it, you benefit from it, and it's gone. On the other side of the spectrum, wood, if you would be cooking, right? If you would be cooking, so if the fuel is a wood-burning stove, right? Okay, so you have to let it go, or a barbecue. You have to let it burn for a while till it becomes charcoal, and then the heat, right? When you start a barbecue, you light it up, and then you come back in 20 minutes once the coals are now producing heat, right? So that's an example of where the hana and the biur are not shava. Because the hana, the heat that the charcoal provides, the wood provides, is only coming after it's been consumed, after the wood has been consumed. Okay? So therefore, firewood, lumber, aravos, not subject to this. Hadassim, so what about the smell? So when you smell hadassim, that doesn't make the hadassim consumed in any way, right? But, so the Yishalmi is not sure. Is it the pshat that they must be consumed at the same time as the benefit, or is it just as opposed to the firewood where the benefit comes after the consumption? But maybe the hadassim, where it's still intact when you're benefiting from it, as long as you're not benefiting from it after it's gone, it's still subject to Shemitah. That's the subject of the Yishalmi, and this has relevance to the flower market in Israel. If you were in Israel at all this year and you passed by a florist, you'll see hashkachas on the window that the flowers were not subject to Shemitah. They were subject to Shemitah depending on where they harvested them from. Okay? Because flowers, at least most flowers, produce an aroma, and that's one of the reasons people buy them. Right? So it just means you have to dispose of them properly. If you spend time in Israel during Shemitah, you can still buy things that are subject to Shemitah. It's wonderful to buy them. You just have to know how to dispose of them. Hopefully we'll get back to that soon. Okay, so now we're talking about esrogim, because that's really the most common question. Okay, so they certainly have Kedusha Shvias. Okay, why would people avoid buying, and I'm not advocating this, why would people avoid buying Israeli esrogim this year? Why are they looking for Moroccan? Why are they looking for Italian or California esrogim? So there's a few issues. One is the issue of the fact that it's definitely possible some of the esrogim that are coming to America were produced on a field where the owners of the field did not properly observe Shemitah. Okay, either they worked the field, they pruned the esrogim orchards, or whatever they needed to do to care for the trees, or they guarded them. They didn't allow open access for anyone to come along and take the esrogim off of the field. That's a great activity for kids, by the way. Take your kids during Shemitah to an esrog pardes. Bring home a souvenir, although we'll talk about whether or not you can bring home a souvenir in a second. But shamor v'neva, that is a question. Can you use for the mitzvah? Can you eat an esrog or any other food that was improperly observed or guarded or worked during Shemitah? So the prevailing opinion is that it is 100% mutter. But there's a minority opinion that held, the Satmar Rebbe held like this, Rav Shechter always quotes the Satmar Rebbe, based on certain Rishonim, Rabbeinu Tam, that if it was guarded or it was tended to during Shemitah improperly, then you can no longer eat it. And anything you can't eat, you can't use for esrog. The Mishnah says you have to be able to eat the esrog to be able to shake it. Okay? That's one reason why people avoid Israeli produce. Again, not advocating that. Another issue is, getting back to the price and the sealed boxes, most of the esrog crop that's going to make it to America is going to come through Otzar Bezdin. Otzar Bezdin works like this. We said earlier that you can't do business with Shemitah produce. So the concept of Otzar Bezdin is that a third party, a Bezdin, takes over administration of the farm or the orchard, harvests whatever can be harvested so it doesn't go to waste, and they distribute it. They give it to yeshivas. They give it to poor people. How do they afford to do that? So they charge fees for the fruits, for the vegetables that cover just the base expenses, the transportation from the farms to the market, or the workers who are physically harvesting them. So when you pay for Otzar Bezdin produce, you're not paying for the fruit. You're only paying for the labor and the logistics involved in getting it to the consumer. Okay? So it sounds like a loophole, but the way the loophole justifies itself is if the price is different. Right? In theory, the price should be, I don't know, 25-30% less than on a normal year, because you don't need to support the farmer in the same way. You just need to cover the expenses and the logistics. So this has been an issue over the years. Sometimes the Otzar Bezdin produce ends up being more expensive. There are reasons for that, economic reasons for that. But it also, sometimes you find Otzar Bezdin produce, esrogim being sold, and they're still graded or at graduated prices, where one costs 70, one costs 60, one costs 50. That's hard to understand. Why should that be so if this is all just a mass market where we're not paying attention to the fruit, we're just paying attention to whatever, you know, goes in to bring the fruit to us. So that's the reason why, hopefully, you'll see Otzar Bezdin produce being sold in these sealed boxes where, you know, Russian roulette, whatever you get, that's what you get. And assuming everything that's put into the boxes are kosher, they may not be $100 rogan, but they'll be acceptable. You'll be yotze to the mitzvah if you use whatever you find in those boxes. Some people avoid those rogan because of the shiles involved and how the pricing and how the production or transportation process and the economics work. That's a question that's your best in. Another concern about things coming from Eretz Yisrael is that the Mishnah says you're not allowed to remove produce from Eretz Yisrael that grew during Shemitah. The Kedusha Shavias, the holiness of those fruits, again, if you take an apple with you on the plane after your visit to Eretz Yisrael, just, you know, for a snack on the airplane, make sure you don't bring it into the country. You'll have customs problems. But if you just want to have an apple in the on the way before you have to turn in all your produce, I guess before you get off the plane. You can't get off the plane with any produce. So strictly speaking, to bring fruit for a little snack to Chutz Lars would not be a problem. But with any greater numbers than that, it's prohibited to bring Kedusha Shvias produce outside of Eretz Yisrael. Probably only in Eretz Rabbanah, because, very simple rationale, if we allowed an influx of Shemitah produce to America, when the vast majority of produce in America is not Shemitah produce, then it's very easy for people to get confused and not dispose of the Shemitah produce properly, because they're just doing what they do with all the other things. And that's what happens when you go to Costco and they're selling the Jaffa oranges or the mandarin or whatever, the carrots that come from Eretz Yisrael, and people don't know how to properly dispose of them. And then, you know, we have to put out an alert, send out an email so that people know that these are different. So that's another reason. Once it's already here, though, we paskin, if you buy it in America, it's mutter. How they get it here, so you have to use some fancy footwork to explain that, but strictly speaking, once it gets to America, if you buy produce such as the esrog, and you want to use it full of an esrog, even though it perhaps should not have been taken out of Eretz Yisrael in the first place, it's okay. There is one way to help deal with that, and you'll see in the coming months, advertisements of collections, people bringing esrogim back to Israel after Sukkot is over. Yeshiva guys going back to learn after Yontif, they bring esrogim back and they dispose of them properly in Eretz Yisrael. Ramosha says that's not necessary, but there are those who hold it is a requirement, and I'm sure in the Jewish newspapers there will be such advertisements for you to avail yourself of that service. Maybe pay for it, I don't know. But the reason why that may not be necessary is because if you've spent time in Eretz Yisrael during Shemitah, you know that one of the methods for proper care of Shemitah produce after, let's say you have a banana and you don't finish every last morsel, every last trace of the banana, when you're done eating it. So what do you do with it? Actually, you have a pach Shemitah. They have a little box. It's not your garbage can. It's not a compost. It's a separate, dedicated receptacle for Shemitah produce. And the idea behind it is, if you put it there with no intention of degrading it, no intention of ruining it in any way, which would occur if you threw it in the garbage and rendered it inedible, if it becomes inedible on its own because it spoils, because the mice get to it, so it's no longer subject to Shemitah. Anything that's not edible is not subject to Shemitah. Getting back to what we said earlier, lochem le'ochla. So, what do you do with your Eser Ogim? If you don't turn it into a jelly, if you do, then you're good, because you dispose of the Shemitah produce properly by making it edible and finishing it off. Alternatively, if you just let the Eser Ogim sit for a few months, it dries up, and there's not much more you can do with it at that point. So if it dries up by Shvat, and it becomes inedible through those means, then strictly speaking, again, it would not be required to bring it back to Eretz Yisrael according to anybody, because it's no longer vested with that Kedusha Shemitah any longer. Okay, a couple more minutes. We'll try to cover a couple more points. What about the lulav? Let's talk about the lulav for a second. So the lulav, the Gemara seems to indicate that the lulav does have Kedusha Shvius. Why is that so? Okay, so the Gemara says if you have it's a Mishnah, if you have an Esrog and you want to buy the Esrog, so there's a problem when it comes to Shemitah, a challenge, that if I give money to a person selling me the Shemitah produce, the money also takes on the Kedusha of Shvius. And that money needs to be spent in a way where it's consumed properly. So this is one of the complications in Eretz Yisrael, why there's hashkachas on this supermarket and that supermarket, because if you give the money to a person who doesn't know how to deal with it properly, so then you may be considered violating a form of lifnei iver. I'm setting him up for failure. So there are different ways around it. One way around it is the concept of havla. If anyone or their kids worked as a waiter for the caterers, or for maybe they laned, or they did anything else that required them to do something on Shabbos, and you're not supposed to get paid for things you do on Shabbos. So we usually assume that one way to circumvent that is with the concept of havla. Havla literally means to swallow something up. You swallow up the services rendered into a bigger series of services. I'm babysitting. So if I babysit Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and also babysit on Shabbos, and you pay the babysitter for a week's worth of services, then it's not designated as Schar Shabbos, which is problematic. Likewise, if you sell someone a lulav and esrog, and you tell them, I'm charging $100 for the lulav, and the esrog is on me. Such a nice guy. Okay? So then, the money that's being transferred is not subject to Kedusha Shvius, because you purchase it with the lulav, right? So that seems to indicate that the lulav has no Shemitah status. But then the Gemara says, no, it must be talking about a lulav that grew in the sixth year. So all the Mepharshim are trying to explain, why would a lulav have the rules of Shemitah applied to it? It's not edible. So Rashi says they used to use it as a broom. They used to use a lulav as a broom. Almost done. They used to use a lulav as a broom. That's one of the reasons why in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, you're not supposed to sweep on Shabbos. Why? Because the types of brooms they used to use, they would break all the time. Because lulav is not so sturdy. Our brooms, you buy at Home Depot, it'll last you for 10 years. So you don't need to worry about that. But Rashi says the reason why the lulav would be subject to Shemitah is because there's a hana. What do we say the description? Hanasun of Urun Shava. The benefit you derive from the item and its destruction and its consumption are simultaneous. That's what happens with the broom. So, based on Rashi's understanding, that for that reason, lulav would be subject to the rules of Shemitah. However, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and other contemporary poskim say, nowadays no one uses the lulav for sweeping. So, even if there's 1% of the world who does it, or maybe in a third world country, we don't need to be concerned about that. That's not the normal use by any stretch of the imagination. So, lulav does not have the rules of Shemitah, which means that you're going to pay a lot for your lulav. Even if they can't charge you a lot for the esrog, now maybe they can raise the prices a little bit more on the lulav. Okay, I hope that provides a little overview. If you have any specific questions, happy to talk further. Again, I'm not advocating against purchasing lulav and esrogim from Israel. There are certainly sound halachic basis for doing so, but if you want to know the landscape of the market this year, these are some of the considerations that go into the question. Israel.